Evacuating Afghans who worked with the U.S. will be tricky. These operations are often rushed, like getting Kurds out of Iraq 25 years ago.
I was the guy saying, okay, go, we're done, we're loaded, telling the pilots, go.
Also today, the FBI told an Iranian-American dissident she wasn't safe.
I was making joke about it and telling them that, look, I receive daily death threats. So what is new?
What is new is that it was not a joke. I'm Marco Werman, and European scientists trying to redirect lightning with a laser.
It's a little bit as if we would be Ben Franklin and we would have these lightning kites.
But with a really long string. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to be with you. We begin the show today with a brazen case of espionage. Iranian spies allegedly tried to kidnap an Iranian-American dissident in New York. The plot would have forced the writer-journalist into a military-style speedboat, then head to Venezuela, and perhaps eventually Iran. It is dramatic, but the head of New York's FBI said this was not some far-fetched movie plot. It was real. Details were unsealed yesterday in an indictment charging four Iranians with conspiring to kidnap. U.S. federal prosecutors did not identify the kidnapping target, but Iranian-American journalist Masih Alinejad confirms she was the target of the plot. Masih joins us now from Brooklyn. How have you been feeling since this indictment was announced?
I'm trying to feel good because I know that the regime is trying to make me feel miserable, but I'm doing my best to make them miserable, to be honest.
When did you first learn about this plot to kidnap you, and what makes you sure it was you?
I was told by the FBI like 8 months ago. They came to my house and they announced that, like face to face, that you're not safe here in your house. I was making joke about it and telling them that, look, I receive daily death threats. So what is new? And they actually came later and they showed me that I am under surveillance. The intelligence service are taking photos of me, filming my movement here in Brooklyn. And that's why I took them serious when they sent me to safe houses.
You took them seriously. What did you think initially when they told you all this?
Look, we always hear that Iranian dissidents and journalists are not safe in Europe. But always, always people think that here in America, they're not going to do anything. And that was the first time that I saw these officials so close to myself, especially when I saw private pictures of my stepchildren, private picture of my husband, even me watering my garden. And it was like, wow, they're following me. They're chasing me here in New York. And then I heard the details 10 minutes before the statement came out that they were trying to take me with a boat to Venezuela and kidnap me from there. I was like, okay, they're going to do the same what they did to Ruhollah Zam, another Iranian dissident journalist, a year ago. They did the same. They kidnapped him from Iraq, and then they executed him in Iran.
So you mentioned that you were taken to a safe house, yeah? The FBI took you to a safe house.
Yes, they did. And they actually asked me to cooperate with them without mentioning this. They wanted me to go live on Instagram. So they were trying actually to find whether the intelligence service is going to find my location. And they did.
So let me get this straight. The FBI, it sounds like they wanted to use you as kind of a bait almost.
Actually, I was a little bit worried, but I made sure that I'm going to be safe. And I had a goal because I wanted them to be identified. And now I'm so happy at least four of them, including one American citizen, are being identified.
So presumably you believed at that point and now that you're in danger.
To be honest, it's not only me in danger. Of course, the government actually interrogated my mother. They brought my sister on TV to disown me publicly. They arrested my brother. Right now that I'm talking to you, my brother is in prison just because of being my brother. And the Iranian Revolutionary Court made a law saying that anyone send videos to Masih Alinejad will be charged up to 10 years prison. So you see, they did everything to keep me silent, and now they're trying to scare me in New York.
You said your brother is in jail in Iran. Will you continue speaking out against the regime there?
7,000 people got arrested in Iran protests, and all of them are like my brothers and sisters. You know, it's not an easy decision. Do you really understand that how sometimes I cannot breathe, how I feel when I think about this is 21st century and I'm not allowed to hug my family? It's not an easy decision at all. But freedom is not free. And I'm sure that the blame should be put on the hostage takers. And sometimes they're trying to make me feel guilty. And I always tell myself that those who shot people in the head, those who lashes people, those who hanged people for protesting, those who beaten up people in the street for just having a normal life should feel guilty. Not me fighting for my dignity.
How would you like the Biden administration to respond to your case in terms of its own relationship with Iran?
Oh, my God. Actually, that breaks my heart because I just heard that they called this kidnapping law enforcement issue. This is not a law enforcement issue. This oppression speaks volumes to how the Islamic Republic thinks of Western values. And actually, this kidnapping and killings of the dissidents must be condemned, not just, you know, burying human rights under nuclear deal. Because if you don't fight this religious dictatorship, then it's going to infect the rest of the world. Right now that I'm talking to you, the U.S. citizen, the Swedish citizen, the British citizen, German citizen, French citizen, they are in Iranian prison because the government took them hostage and using them like bargaining chip. So you see, I want the Biden's administration to understand that I'm not fighting for myself. I'm actually fighting for my people, that they don't have any voice. And this is my duty. And I want Biden administration to support me and support millions of other people who are crying for justice.
When you fled Iran, Masi, you had had your press credentials revoked by the government of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. You did not feel safe. You thought being abroad in the U.S., for example, would give you safety. Did you think at the time that the arms of leaders in Tehran would stretch this far outside the country?
Oh my, that's such a question. I cannot believe it. Yeah, you're right. No, I never thought. I always thought that here they don't dare to reach out to dissidents. But when Islamic Republic is in power, when ISIS is in power, when Taliban is in power, no one would feel the same around the world.
Masi Ahmadinejad is an Iranian-American author, journalist, and a critic of the regime in Iran, speaking with us about an alleged plot by the Iranian government to kidnap her here on U.S. soil. Masi, thank you very much for your time.
It was a pleasure for me. Thank you.
As the U.S. military winds down its mission in Afghanistan, the Biden administration says that it will start evacuating some Afghans at the end of this month. The U.S. has a long history of evacuating wartime allies, Vietnamese in 1975, Kurdish refugees, and Kosovo Albanians in the 1990s. Many of them were taken to the American territory of Guam in the Western Pacific before resettling in the U.S. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, looked back at that history and what it could mean for the latest evacuees.
It's 1996, and a large jet touches down at night in Guam. Families, refugees, walk down the steps, relieved after fleeing Iraq and Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. It was an historic moment, and Francis Ricciardone remembers these families well.
Many of us formed personal relationships with them. We saw many of them as truly heroic.
Ricciardone is a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, and he helped evacuate Kurdish refugees who went to Turkey first and were then flown to Guam. Nearly 7,000 Iraqi Kurds were evacuated.
I was a guy saying, okay, go, we're done, we're loaded, telling the pilots, go.
He remembers seeing Kurdish families boarding planes in Turkey, heading to safer ground.
I saw children, women, men, young men, old people who had faced terrifying scenes at home, who had lost loved ones. It was very, very moving.
A similar scene happened in 1975, after the Vietnam War. The U.S. evacuated about 130,000 refugees to Guam before they were resettled to the U.S. Today, Afghans who worked with U.S. forces hope for similar help. They've been drivers and cooks and interpreters and have faced deadly Taliban threats for that work. They've been waiting and waiting for U.S. visas. Ricciardone knows the complexities of these evacuations and what's possible.
I mean, our military are great, incredible logistic challenges. And if you combine that with our diplomatic political capabilities of organizing, you know, working with allies and non-allies, these are well within U.S. capabilities. Given the will and the resources, these things are doable.
President Biden says evacuation flights will happen this month, but it's unclear how many Afghans might get help. About 18,000 Afghans who've worked with the U.S. military are seeking special U.S. visas. That number could go to 70,000 if spouses and children are included. And where might people go? There's no official word yet, but countries like the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait have been mentioned. Doug Livermore says this makes sense. He's with the U.S. Special Forces Association and advocates for Afghan allies. He says it's better if Afghans stay closer to home in case their visas are rejected.
It's far easier from a practical perspective for them to be returned to Afghanistan from whatever that location is versus, you know, all the way back from Guam or the continental United States.
But being sent to a third country would generally mean fewer rights for evacuated Afghans than if they touched U.S. soil. Krish Omara Vignaraja is president of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service.
If the applicant is on American soil, they at least have access to legal humanitarian protections through immigration court, including the option to seek asylum.
If taken to a third country,
there isn't a guarantee of an ability to seek asylum, nor is there any guarantee against these individuals being immediately deported, even if that deportation is essentially signing their death warrant.
Ambassador Ricciardone says there's another reason why a large-scale airlift to a U.S. territory like Guam might not happen.
It's a different America, you know. There's much more concern now, all these years, 20 years after 9/11, about people intending to do us harm coming to the country. Every law that is passed, every regulation that is put into place has been to make it harder and harder to enter the United States, even for the most legitimate purposes, the purposes that we desire foreigners to come.
In Afghanistan, Jaleel, who worked as an interpreter for the U.S. military for years, is waiting to hear more about an evacuation.
Every person, like every family, they're thinking about and they're listening to the TVs and they're worried about their future.
He's received horrible threats from the Taliban, which is why we're only using his first name. His wife worries every time he leaves the house.
She's worried about me and our kids. Every time she hears anything on the news or social media, she shares it with me. She doesn't let me go out unless I have to. We spend most of our time at our house.
He's also had his U.S. visa appointments postponed several times. He read me a recent email he got from U.S. officials.
Do not come to the embassy on the day of your appointment. You will receive an updated appointment date and time by email. We acknowledge and regret the inconvenience to applicants.
He now has a visa interview scheduled for next week. But he isn't sure if that means he and his family will be on a path out or whether they, like many, many other Afghans, will stay home. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
Coming up later in the show, want to understand the anger in Cuba? The island nation relies heavily on tourism. That's fallen off a cliff.
The reduction has been from 4.2 million tourists in 2019 to 1.2 million tourists in 2020.
It's been even worse in 2021. That's later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Europe took some big steps today in doing its part to curb climate change. The European Commission unveiled a slew of proposals, including slapping a price on carbon emissions for new sectors like aviation and shipping, as well as placing limits on greenhouse gas emissions from tailpipes. Then there was another idea that will no doubt ruffle a lot of feathers globally, placing a carbon tax on imports. Here to explain what that is and what Europe is trying to do is The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler. So, Carolyn, this border tax on carbon scheme, tell us about that and how it would work.
Yeah, it's a tax on imports for certain products that require a lot of carbon emissions to produce. So cement, electricity, fertilizer, iron, steel, and aluminum. These taxes basically will match what EU producers will be paying when they produce the same things in their own emissions trading program. It won't start being paid until 2026 and then ramped up to its full amount until 2035.
So what's the overall goal that the European Commission is trying to reach?
The goal is to prevent a problem that's kind of inherent as different countries move at different paces to deal with climate change. Basically, production of high carbon products shifting from countries with lots of rules and taxes on them to places with fewer regulations. So the EU says the rule is meant to prevent that shift and also kind of nudge industry outside of the EU to take steps to clean up their production. You know, but it's already facing criticism from trade partners because it's a tariff and it can be seen as, you know, protectionist of EU industry. And that might have been what European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen was thinking about when she said this today when she unveiled the proposals.
Change on this scale is never easy. And for that reason, there are some who will say we should go slower, we should go lower, we should do less. But when it comes to climate change, doing less or doing nothing literally means changing everything.
Right. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen there. So where is the criticism coming from mostly, Carolyn?
There's been a lot of criticism from countries who are going to be most impacted by this tax, including China, Turkey, Ukraine, and Russia, as well as steel producers in some of those countries. And countries like the U.S. worry that this will create tension ahead of a key U.N. climate summit in November where countries really all need to be cooperating. I spoke to someone at an environmental think tank in Europe called E3G, Damien van Jenechten, who says his group is in general in favor of the idea of trying to prevent what's called carbon leakage, but he's cautious about this particular proposal.
Because we increasingly see the risks of this and we fear that the risks might outweigh the benefits, we are advocating a lot of caution towards policymakers, like taking into account these international concerns.
So this proposal for an import tax on carbon that just came out today, what happens next?
So the 27 EU member countries are going to have to negotiate about this and the EU Parliament. So it's likely to be months, if not years, before this is actually finalized. And there's also likely to be some lobbying and negotiating from both industry sectors and other countries.
And is the European Union likely to be receptive to overtures from trade partners to revise this proposal?
Yes, this proposal does seem very open to debate. There will be ways that countries who are taking strong action on climate change can have their industries either exempt or treated in a different way by this tax, and there are likely to be conversations about that. And Paolo Gentiloni, a European commissioner, seemed to pave the way for those types of conversations today when he was talking about this proposal.
This will be a sort of premiere at international level, and this means that also we are ready to try to find a balance between our ambition and the necessity of global cooperation.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this progresses. The World's Environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
The invention of the lightning rod is credited to Benjamin Franklin, and until now, that's been the main tool for protecting buildings and people in them from lightning strikes, a metal rod mounted often at the apex of a structure. Now a team in Europe is testing a new method for diverting lightning bolts with a laser beam. This laser lightning rod, that's what it's called, is on a Swiss mountaintop that gets struck by lightning 100 times each year. Physicist Jean-Pierre Wolf from the University of Geneva leads the project. He joins us now, not from the mountain. Jean-Pierre, you're on vacation, so thanks for making the time to speak with us. So the way I understand a conventional lightning rod, it's made of metal, which is grounded, right? So the lightning goes through the structure with people in it, but the electricity goes into the ground. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. But the problem is that the length of this metal rod cannot be extensively long. And a lightning rod usually protects an area of size which is equal to the height of the lightning rod. So if you have a 10-meter lightning rod, it will protect your house, but not more.
So is the same true with a laser lightning rod? Where does the lightning actually go?
The way we use it, we use our laser, is that we produce this metal rod in the air by ionizing the air with the laser. So basically, you switch on the laser goes through the air, it ionizes the air, it frees the electrons. They can move then, and they act as if it was a metal bar. And so in this way, you have a lightning rod, which you can switch on and off, and the length of the laser light.
Mm. So you're still sending the lightning into the ground. You're just capturing it at a much higher altitude in the air to protect a larger area.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit as if we would be Ben Franklin, and we would have this lightning kite, but the length of your wire would be as long as you want.
Got it.
You catch the lightning bolt at a higher altitude, yes.
How much power does the laser lightning rod use? Would it be a threat, perhaps, to aircraft or birds flying overhead?
There is no harm possible on the material itself. So we will not drill holes in an aircraft or things like that. But of course, it's not eye safe. So there should be no aircraft in the beam because the pilot could look into it and things like that.
So you've been testing it on a mountaintop in Switzerland for several months, Jean-Pierre. How is the laser lightning rod performing? Has this technology worked yet?
No, not yet. We've been working on it for many years. And there were many, many experiments on the lab scale. And the point is that very often it works on the lab scale, but then when you go to the real life, things are different. We tried an experiment like this in 2005 in New Mexico. We were on the top of a mountain for 3 months in New Mexico, and we were really not fortunate because we had only 3 thunderstorms. So it was a bit disappointing because, of course, it's a large effort. Hopefully it will not be the case here in Switzerland this year.
So what needs to happen for this laser lightning rod to work? When do you expect to divert a lightning strike with a laser?
Yeah, the big success would be, say, a picture where you see that along, say, a kilometer, the lightning follows the laser beam and reaches the ground. So that would be the demonstration that the system works. And we can also then measure how long the cloud above you will be discharged. So basically, how long you will be safe without laser. Because this is also important. If you think about an application at an airport, what you want to do is switch on the laser, discharge the thundercloud above you, and let the aircraft take off or land. So all these measurements have never been done yet. You know, it's something really, really new.
Well, thanks very much for explaining this. Jean-Pierre Wolf is a physicist at the University of Geneva in Switzerland, telling us about the laser lightning rod. And you're going back to the mountain next week?
Tomorrow, actually.
Tomorrow. Well, good luck. We're wishing you bad weather.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The World. It's been a week since Haiti's president was assassinated, and Haitian expats across the globe are no closer to making sense of things.
Everyone I know is just glued to the radio and, you know, glued to their phones and trying to figure out, trying to put the pieces together of what might have happened.
Haitians use a diaspora pipeline to try to find answers. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The British government says it's time for the people of Northern Ireland to move forward and put the conflict known as the Troubles behind them once and for all. It was a violent period. Before the Good Friday Peace Agreement was signed in 1998, more than 3,500 people had been killed. Now the government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson has introduced a statute of limitations on prosecutions from 1998 on back. The World's Orla Barry is on the line from London to explain. So what exactly is being proposed here, Orla?
Well, as what you suggested, Marco, the British government announced today it's a proposal bringing an end to any criminal prosecutions of those who carried out killings in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, essentially from the 70s right up until April 1998 when the Good Friday Agreement was signed. So any investigations into killings perpetrated by former British soldiers or police officers in Northern Ireland, they will all be stopped. And also there will be no further prosecution of paramilitary groups either, like the IRA or the UVA. Or the UDA for any killings that they carried out during the Troubles over those 30 years.
And why now, 23 years after the Good Friday Accord? What is the British government saying is the reason for this decision?
Well, Brendan Lewis, the Northern Ireland Secretary, said today the current system dealing with the legacy of the Troubles simply isn't working, is how he put it. He said the Police Service of Northern Ireland is considering almost 1,200 cases at the moment, and because more than two-thirds of the deaths took place over 40 years ago, he claims that the courts are finding it increasingly difficult to prosecute anyone. In fact, in May, a trial against two soldiers for a murder in Belfast in 1972, it collapsed after the judge ruled that crucial evidence couldn't be used, and then a trial against two further soldiers for killings in Derry has also been dropped in the last few weeks. But the Prime Minister Boris Johnson also said today that there are many British soldiers who continue to face what he called the threat of vexatious prosecutions, and they are now into their 70s and 80s, and he says this new legislation will draw a line under the Troubles.
So it sounds like there's a practical side here, just lots of potential cold cases that will be extremely difficult to prosecute.
That's what they argue, and that's what the Northern Irish Secretary is saying today. But the victims groups are saying, well, actually, no one really made that much of an effort to prosecute them 20, 30, almost 40 years ago now. You know, they could have made the effort back over the decades, but they didn't do so. So this is the sort of the legacy that they're dealing with now.
I know some family members of relatives killed during the Troubles have been really outspoken about seeking justice. How are they responding to this news?
Yeah, they're furious, to put it mildly. I mean, they had an inkling that this was coming, but those I spoke to today said they're still shocked that the British government is proposing this. I spoke to Kate Nash earlier. She lives in Derry. Her brother William was shot dead by British soldiers in 1972 on Bloody Sunday during a civil rights march in Derry that day.
William was only 19 when he was killed, murdered, I should say. And my father then went out to help him, and he got shot too. You know, the whole thing was a nightmare.
And Kate has been campaigning for years for the soldier responsible for her brother's death to be brought to justice. So I said to her, well, you know, is she going to give up her campaign now following today's news?
Oh, no. No, 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 no. We don't throw in the towel. Oh, my God, we've jumped through hoops over the years. We really have, you know. And it's so exhausting, the whole thing's so exhausting. But giving up, it'll never happen. There's no line. There is no line that's going to be drawn here.
Finally, Orla, what about the political leadership in Ireland and Northern Ireland? What's been their reaction to this?
Well, for once, all political parties in Ireland are united on this one. And that's a rarity, I can tell you. As one Northern Irish politician, Stephen Farrey with the Alliance Party, said earlier, this isn't drawing a line, as Boris Johnson put it, under anything. It's crossing the line. You know, nobody's happy. Sinn Féin said this afternoon this is effectively an amnesty for British soldiers who went onto the streets of Derry and gunned down innocent civilians, is how they were putting it. And then the Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, the DUP, the largest Unionist party there, said that they didn't want to see British soldiers and police officers being treated in the same way as terrorists, because their point is that they don't want members of the IRA to be left off the hook either. The Taoiseach Micheál Martin, the Irish Prime Minister, said that this was a unilateral action by the British government and it was a breach of trust and a betrayal of the victims, etc. But the British government is saying today it plans to introduce the legislation in the autumn, and as you know, Boris Johnson has a majority in the House of Commons, so he does have the votes to get this bill passed if he wants to.
23 years after the Good Friday Accord, another turn of the screw. The World's Orla Barry in London, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
5 years ago this week, there was a dramatic coup attempt in Turkey. Hundreds died, scores more were injured. The violence was a major turning point in Turkey. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's government prosecuted hundreds of people whom it accused of being connected to the plotters of the coup. From Istanbul, Duri Buscarin sent this report.
It was a Friday night. Gökçen Tuncer had just come home from her shift at a news agency in Istanbul, and she got a text from her boss.
The markets felt something was wrong before everyone else. To our WhatsApp group, our editor-in-chief wrote, like, something is happening. Did you check the dollar?
She grabbed her laptop to start writing and switched on the news. A huge bridge that crosses the Bosphorus Strait near her apartment had been blocked by coup soldiers. The air was filled with the sounds of gunfire as civilians rushed to the bridge. Fighter jets overhead shook the windows. She called her dad, who lived through Turkey's coup in 1980.
Like, he just said, like, calm, get calm. And he said, like, do not go out. Stay away from the windows. And I was like, okay.
On television, Tunjer saw that the Turkish parliament building in Ankara had been bombed. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan FaceTimed in to Turkish CNN, and as an anchor held up the phone, he called for civilians to take to the streets to resist the coup.
During the broadcast, you hear the sounds of the soldiers and the yellings and, you know, like some sort of clashes and stuff. And the last image I saw on TV was my friend, and I freaked out.
Her friend was okay, but more than 250 people died that night. Thousands were injured. The Turkish military had already begun rounding up soldiers who were involved in the plot. The government laid the blame on people linked to Fethullah Gulen, a cleric who was once a political ally of Erdogan. He lives in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania. The U.S. has refused to extradite him. The morning after the coup attempt, the Turkish government remained in power, and life felt almost normal, except that it wasn't.
Within days of the coup attempt itself, the lists were ready, decrees were published.
Emma Sinclair Webb is the Turkey director for Human Rights Watch. She saw as lists of thousands of names were printed and posted publicly. They were civil servants, teachers, police officers, lawyers, and judges that the government claimed were connected to Gulen.
It's represented as an existential threat to the life of the nation that justified the very heavy crackdown that followed.
130,000 people were dismissed from their jobs, blacklisted from working in the public sector, and banned from leaving the country. This is in addition to hundreds of alleged coup plotters who were prosecuted for their active involvement in the events, and then an additional wave of arrests on Turkey's political opposition, leftists, and protesters.
An intensified targeting of critics, of opposition politicians, the introduction immediately of emergency powers, which enabled mass arrests, mass dismissals, showed how Erdogan was ready to cash in on this coup attempt and use it to consolidate his own power.
This week, commemoration events are planned throughout the country, and a Turkish metro line screens replay a trailer for a new movie put out by the country's public broadcaster. In this reenactment, an elderly woman wraps herself in a Turkish flag and walks towards the coup soldiers who have blocked off the bridge and is killed.
Those who die trying to protect democracy in Turkey should be commemorated, but the government's creating this annual ceremony around the coup, I think, is also a coup attempt, is also a way for Erdogan to rally his base.
Soner Çağatay directs the Turkish research program at the Washington Institute. Though human rights had been backsliding in Turkey for some time, he points to this coup attempt as the moment that Erdogan really centralized his powers.
The post-coup Turkey has not only seen a really broad crackdown of peaceful and democratic opposition groups by Erdogan, but also consolidation of political power, so much political power in his hands that we haven't seen this kind of consolidation in Turkey's democratic history ever before.
Today, Erdogan made a speech to his party, saying his country's fight against the coup's plotters will continue until its last member is neutralized. Turkey, he said, has the power to find and destroy all threats to the integrity of its homeland, unity of the nation, and survival of the state. For the world, I'm Derya Buzgarin in Istanbul.
When Cuba exploded with protests over the weekend, much of the anger was about pocketbook issues, frustrations about chronic shortages of goods, including food. Cuba has long lived under the U.S. embargo, which was expanded under the Trump administration. Then the pandemic made daily life really hard. Arturo López Levy grew up in Cuba and worked as an analyst for the Cuban government. He left 20 years ago. He now teaches at Holy Names University in Oakland, California. You travel a lot, Arturo, between California and Cuba, or at least you did before the pandemic. What kind of economic hardships are Cubans dealing with on a daily basis right now?
The two most important problems for the average Cuban today is food and uncertainty about the pandemic, and particularly how long this economic situation will last. Cuba imports 72% of the food that is consumed. And its main sources of income in this area are tourism and remittances. In the case of tourism, the reduction has been from 4.2 million tourists that Cuba received in 2019 to 1.2 million tourists in 2020 and 122,000 in the first half of 2021. This is a big source of currency. The second part is the remittances. Most Cubans relied a lot on remittances because these products are sold in dollar stores. Now, due to the sanctions, particularly those that were imposed by Trump, there has been a big hit on remittances, and President Biden has not changed that.
Arturo, what options does the Biden administration actually have to improve things for Cubans?
The first thing is that the 242 new sanctions adopted by President Trump were taken by executive order. So President Biden, although he cannot remove unilaterally the whole embargo, he basically can pass an executive order tomorrow and say all the 242 new sanctions, particularly those against remittances and those who had a humanitarian effect, are removed. Second, President Biden said America is back. In the issue of Cuba, this is a test case because if there is an issue in which the United States and its allies are not in line, is the issue of the U.S. embargo.
Cuba's economy used to be very heavily dependent on revenues from sugar, but it pivoted from that almost 20 years ago. Remind us what happened there.
By the early 2000s, the prices of sugar were quite depressed, and Fidel Castro said that Cuba should move to an economy in which Cuba tried to substitute imports of food like rice and beans that are basic staples in the Cuban table. The argument was to move the agriculture from sugar to this import substitution. In practice, what happened is that the sugar industry was destroyed, but the substitutes were not properly developed. And what the Cuban economy did was to rely more and more on tourism and remittances for importing food. And now we have the consequences.
But just to be clear, you're saying kind of like the initial kind of step in this was Fidel Castro wanting to grow food for Cubans to eat instead of growing sugar and exporting it.
At least to reduce sugar to only 1 million tons of sugar harvest and not the goals that Cuba has tried to achieve in the past. For instance, I think by 1986, 1987, Cuba had a harvest of almost 9 million tons.
As you look, Arturo, at what's happening on the island, what is your assessment? Are the current protests mostly about the economy or are they about politics?
I think the two factors are intermingled because the problems that I have mentioned on finding the right policy to deal with issues such as agriculture, how to make the Cuban economy succeed despite the odious policy of sanctions, has to do also with some narrow visions that has characterized the Leninist regime that they have in Cuba, in which one party claimed to be the avant-garde and having the truth and the scientific view about how to deal with this issue. In my view, the Cuban Communist Party, they should enter into a big diet of humble pie and try to have a dialogue with other people and listen more, people that although they are non-communists, they might have something important to say from their own perspective beyond the idea of control that is so typical in a Leninist government.
Give us some examples. Like what are three realistic reforms the Cuban government can kind of pull off in the short run to make things better?
Open investment from the Cuban diaspora is a very important thing that countries like Vietnam, China, and these countries did. Without any ideological litmus test, if people are ready to go and honor the Cuban laws and invest money in Cuba, do it. Second, promote more the idea of foreign investment. Third, I would say liberalize the agricultural sector that is in desperation and liberalize the importation of agricultural equipment to promote as much as possible domestic agriculture to substitute the heavy dependence on food imports.
Arturo López-Levy teaches at Holy Names University in Oakland, California. He's the author of Raúl Castro and the New Cuba, A Close-Up View of Change. Arturo, thanks very much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure.
You're used to hearing voices on the world that take you to the heart of the day's big stories. Follow us on Instagram to see some of the people behind those voices. You can find us at theworld.org/Instagram or get a glance at what I'm seeing. I'm at Marco Werman. It's July 14th, Bastille Day in France. To mark the occasion, here's a controversial song, reviled even when it came out more than four decades ago, the first gold record for Serge Gainsbourg. So, obviously, not everyone in France hated it. This is Aux Armes, etc., Gainsbourg's blasé riff on the French national anthem, La Marseillaise, recorded in Kingston, Jamaica, with the best studio musicians money could buy. At the time, some in France said the song was a profanity against everything they hold sacred. Gainsbourg was inspired by the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen, which came out in 1977. The Sex Pistols, in turn, were inspired by Jimi Hendrix's Star Spangled Banner. From Jimmy to Johnny to Serge, it all connects. Happy Bastille Day.
Allons dans le fond de la patrie. Le jour de gloire est arrivé. Contre nous de la tyrannie. L'étendard sanglant.
Here's something for our When Super Hard Just Isn't Hard Enough file. Pro cyclist Lachlan Morton just finished all 21 stages of the Tour de France with his final laps of the Champs-Élysées in Paris. Hang on a minute, I hear you say. That's not the normal thunder of applause at the finish line. And the tour isn't over. The rest of the riders are still cycling the French mountains. This Australian rider, he completed something arguably more impressive. It's called the Alt Tour. Lachlan's ride included not only more than 2,000 miles of the official tour, he also rode the transfers between stages, adding another 1,300 miles. NBC Sports caught up with Lachlan during his Alt Tour.
Generally, I'm doing close to 300 kilometers each day.
That's 186 miles.
Yeah, when you take into account the weight of the bike and the amount of altitude meters, it makes for some very long days.
No doubt. The Tour de France is already one of the hardest endurance contests on the planet. Why make it harder? Here's Lachlan again on NBC.
We're trying to celebrate the origins of the tour and raise some money for a good cause at the same time. And also, I think, just to put me through a whole bunch of hell.
The final stage did not reflect that personal hell, though. To avoid traffic, Lachlan finished up on Tuesday, rolling down the Champs-Élysées while Paris was asleep. Then popped open a bottle. French champagne, of course. It has been a week since Haiti's president Jovenel Moïse was assassinated, and the political chaos there is nowhere near settled. For Haitians living outside the country, there's a hunger to connect with other expats. Nathalie Talley-Serrin is one of those people. The Philadelphia-based singer-songwriter just goes by Tali. Her music is a mix of folk music from Haiti and soul. Here's her take on the Haitian folk tune, Cousin.
Cousin. C'est pas ça que t'es doué. Cousin. C'est pas ça que t'es doué. Ou t'es doué mon sac ou blessé avec moi.
Tali is with us from her home in Philadelphia. Welcome, Tali. Good to meet you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So as I said, this is a Haitian folk tune. Tell me about it. What's it about?
At face value, it's a song about a scorned lover, but it's just a song, someone complaining to the spirit about not seeing the fruits of their labor. Haitians are very poetic people, so it's sung for anyone who's broken promises, and I've heard it sung as protest for the government, because who breaks promises more than politicians? I just really slowed it down, and that was my take on it.
So I want to know a little about yourself and your connections today to Haiti. I know you were born in Haiti, but live in Philadelphia now. What's your story, Tali?
Yeah, I was born in Haiti. My family moved here when I was a baby because my parents went to grad school in Philadelphia. So we lived here until I was 7, and then I moved to Haiti. We lived there from when I was 7 to the age of 17. And so I was sent to live here at the end of high school because of, it wasn't safe at the time. 7 to 17 are the important years, the years I became a person, I like to say. So I spent the important formative years in Port-au-Prince.
Right. So you were saying at that time Haiti was not safe. You came back to Philadelphia. Again, we're seeing that today. What are you hearing from family and friends in Haiti this week?
Yeah, there's a lot of questions, a lot of confusion, a lot of theories of what might have happened. You know, the only facts we know is that the president was assassinated. That's what we know for sure. You know, everyone I know is just glued to the radio and, you know, glued to their phones and trying to figure out, trying to put the pieces together of what might have happened. Because, well, you know, this assassination is no cause for celebration at all. I don't see anyone rejoicing in it. But there was a big movement against this president prior to his assassination. And a big movement, you know, asking for answers to corruption and impunity and the, you know, the climate of violence that has been present in Haiti for the last few years and has made life impossible for people over there.
Have you reached out to Haitians here in the U.S. and what are the conversations you've been having?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to separate fake news from real news. So, you know, it's kind of why I do the work I do, because I think people are kind of sometimes confused about what sources to trust. And a lot of the conversations are just untangling the conspiracy theories and the confusion. Some people who don't even believe he was assassinated. And so many questions and a lot of fear. Yeah.
And Tali, when you talk about the work you do, I mean, you're not just a musician, you're also a blogger, right?
Right. So I have an online media outlet that I run with my friends. It's called Woy Magazine, W-O-Y. That's like Creole for wow or whoa. And so it's just kind of a place people can go like, what's going on in Haiti? And we kind of break it down in a very simple way for them. And then we have a podcast with the blog, the newsletter, and there's podcasts that are more Haitian history based.
So as a Haitian observer, writer, podcaster, and musician, what does this moment mean to you, Tali?
I'm pretty upset. I'm pretty upset and worried that this doesn't mean that we're going to repeat same mistakes, you know, because if you look historically in Haiti, in times of really big political upheaval, that's what preceded foreign intervention. And foreign intervention oftentimes means a lot of human rights violations. And so right now, I and other people, we're very nervous about what is the way forward.
Mm. Is your music helping at all? Are you working on any new material?
I am. I've been working on material just based on what I've been seeing this past year in the pandemic. And just, I think like the underlying theme of all my music has always been like, I want to sing about a world I want to see, right? It leads back to what's going on right now. I see activists and, you know, people like myself and regular people in Haiti is we're calling for a Haitian solution to what's going on. A truly Haitian solution, because I think we have not been given that chance to do that.
Well, Tali, while we wait for your new songs to come out, we'll go out with a song today from your previous album. It's a song called Que Pose. What's it about?
I consider it my mission statement. Que Pose, the Creole words mean calm heart. The English equivalent would be peace of mind.
Piti, piti, tout piti, toi, piti.
It's a prayer for myself and the people in my community. We can reach that place where we're okay.
Yeah, that kind of peace of mind, that's a good wish. Haitian musician and blogger Tali Serin speaking with us from Philadelphia. Thank you so much. It's great to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is where we leave you today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be right back here for you tomorrow.